motion picture brains, that's you. Fans of light, darkness, composition, celluloid, zeros and ones, welcome back to another episode of the amazing Through the Lens podcast, the unedited audio of our full conversation with the cinematographer. In this episode, we spoke with wholly unique Tom Richmond, who is known for, amongst other things, the films of Straight to Hell, of House of a Thousand Corpses, Palindromes, Slums of Beverly Hills, Stand and Deliver, I'm Gonna Get You Sucker, and Killing Zoe. Dude, I gotta tell you, this guy has shot a ton, and he is just one wildcat. He's a phenomenal guy. I think he teaches at NYU right now. He's teaching their graduate year cinematography class. He himself is a student of film, a genuine student of film. He knows just a ton, and he has the most warm and quirky personality, and is just a phenomenal guy to be around. And when we sat down, it was just like one of these nonstop, like we're just going back and forth, and we're talking about other people's films and his films, and he's completely modest about it and loves what he does, and you know, he's a killer guy. We met up with him in October of 2012 at Handheld Films in New York, and we just kept going. We went for like 2.5 hours. If you want to check out the Hollywood video version of this interview, you will find it at craftwork.com in season one. I don't know which episode. It's two of them, though. We split it up into two-parter because Tom is just that cool. And, that's my phone ringing. That's my wife. I'm not going to answer it because I'm still doing this intro. And or you can look at youtube.com/crafttruck. You can also subscribe if you're feeling randy. It should be noted that during this interview, Tom picked up the phone, dialed the CIA, and had a SWAT team down at our location in a matter of minutes.
I just want to make sure we get this.
It's just hitting you like right all over this part of your head, which isn't good.
Well, this is what I live for. See, I actually offered.
Oh, but I know why it's there, because of this camera. Yeah, it needs to be further back, really. Now you have to hold it with your left hand up there and then wiggle the bottom. There you go. So this is kind of a six of one, half a dozen of the other, because it might not look as...
No, we use the singles.
Okay, this will be better for a single.
Yeah.
And then there, look over here.
Yeah.
That's good.
Hey, man, this is the first time you lit for Tom Richmond.
That's good. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you lit for Tom Richmond and Alex Ulary at the same time. Now, how are we gonna rotate the light on that thing without burning your hand?
That's okay. Oh,
the light's not super hot.
You're sitting on it. How are we doing, Todd?
That looks pretty good.
All right.
And you know what? It's just that you're... Can you sit closer to me?
I could sit a little closer to you, man.
Without screwing everything up?
Yeah, but I mean, you want me to sit in your lap?
No. It's not, I'm just looking at the
light.
It's
the glasses, right?
That's better.
Is that better?
Yep. No, it was just like lighting under his eye and stuff like that.
I
think it's a little better.
Is it better?
That's it?
Yeah.
Where did you... Okay, so...
The only thing I would still do is like close the doors a little bit.
Sure.
It doesn't need to be quite as strong.
Like that?
Let's see.
You love light, don't you?
Well, it's my just like my survival tool, I would say, more than my job. Yes, that looks good. Right?
Yeah,
I think it looks great. Okay, cool.
So let me ask you, but where did you start getting more into, some photographers give exactly the impression that you give, which is that you don't really get the sense of where they're coming from until all of a sudden you're actually in the moment working, and then you go, oh, I see what they...
Definitely the way I am in terms of, because I'm even teaching now, and I can't quite explain. I just have to do stuff.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, for sure. And you probably also, to a certain degree, like your persona, like you don't mind having people be a little bit thrown off or...
I wouldn't say that's... I would say if that's... the case, which it might be a little bit. It's more, that's from experience. When I started out, especially starting in LA, I am from New York, I'm from the East Coast. Toronto and Montreal have much more in common with New York than LA does.
Yeah.
So I would say that you would be thrown off a little bit in LA too if you had grown up and learned all the social ways of the East Coast.
Right.
So I had so much problems with the whole, like, you know, what do you wear when, like, is your hair perfect? What do you wear when the weather's the same all the time? You know, and like, do you need to go to the gym? And like, it was just all these things that made me really uncomfortable personally.
Just bullshit.
And yeah, but it was like this, but I didn't know it was bullshit. I'm like a young guy trying to compete with these other people.
Right.
So I'm comparing myself to them. I wasn't secured enough in who I was when I went there to go like, the hell with that, I'm this guy. Until I started to get good at what I did, then I became like more comfortable.
Who were the guys that you had to compete with? Like who are the guys that you were colleagues
of
with?
I can tell you my peers at school were interesting. Like Alex Cox. These aren't competition, but nope. Alex Cox, the director, he did Sid and Nancy and Repo Man and The Walker and all these fantastic movies.
Phenomenal.
He was like, we went to school together and I shot some stuff for him. And as far as when I first started competing like against, it took a while before I was a DP that got paid to be a DP.
Right.
And
you shot a lot of stuff for free before that?
Oh, yes. Tons.
Tons. What were we doing for money?
Lighting. I didn't know how to light. But,
but you just lied your way through it.
Well, no, not really. When you go to film school, for one thing, when I went to film school, I went to UCLA, which was a director's school, which I didn't really pay attention to. I just applied to big film schools. I applied to NYU and UCLA when I was like in my mid-20s.
Right.
Like way after I'd finished school. I was just sort of like I was going to be an artist or like a builder or like, I didn't know what I was going to be. It's just like 70s. I'm just going to be like this cool guy. And then I got to be like mid-70s and I hadn't figured out a craft or a way to make a living.
But you got jobs as a gaffer?
Not yet.
On electric?
After I went to film school.
After you went to film school.
No, I didn't even know what film was.
Right.
I mean, I almost literally didn't. I didn't know who made movies.
But you said you were a camera guy, so you like still cameras.
Okay. Still cameras. Yeah, I was going to be a still artist.
Do you have a Pentax and Olympus?
Yes, and I had a Pentax, and then I had a Leica. A Pentax, Leica.
You had a Leica?
I found an old Leica, yeah.
Which
from
Leica?
From Sam, somebody who had like a cabinet full of cameras in the back streets of Boston.
An M3?
I think it was an
M2.
Well, I'm old.
No, that's fabulous.
It was a beautiful old camera. It got stolen. So then I went and got a Pentax. And then eventually I just started using Nikons. But
what lens was on the M2?
The one I lost it, you mean?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
What lens?
Probably a 28 or a 35.
Okay.
Those are the lenses that I mostly used.
Okay, so that was my question.
My still photography, wide-ish lenses.
Why wide?
I think because I liked buildings and places and skies. I used to take a lot of pictures. I started really going crazy with still photography when I went to Houston, Texas to meet some architects.
This is what fascinates me, though, is that there's these general rules. Like if you pick up like some photography book, and all these books are good. They do great. Like, again, the books are, you know, the basics and fundamentals, how to shoot in this situation. And all these books are now becoming, again, sort of repopularized because digital photography is now finally coming around to the point where people are realizing that it was the same craft. It's just that now they can look at it sooner and faster.
That's happening in filmmaking, too.
Exactly. Yeah. We should talk about that then, too. But my point is that there's sort of these general, like, you know, aren't rules meant to be broken? Like, what, a wide lens is for landscapes and, you know, I mean, You talk about close-ups, right? Like, for some of the close-ups in House of a Thousand Corpses, those are wide lenses.
Yeah, yeah, for
and
sure.
You're right there on Sid Haig. You know, like, you've got to be maybe, I'm guessing, 4 or 5 feet from the guy, right?
Less. Yeah, probably less.
Probably less, yes. Yeah. And, you know, so what is it about the rules that, do they really apply, or is it just a good place to start?
a broad answer would be it's a good place to start. But I've been just telling my kid, the students right now, because I'm teaching at NYU.
Yeah.
And I'm basically the one of the last teachers they'll have in their third year cinematography teacher. You know, if you get that far, here's this cool, weird class. And we're teaching 35mm film, which is like, people, I tell people, and they're like, what? Are you serious? Like, and it's almost like a reward for the kids, I think. They've done their digital dues, and they've shot one film on 16. Anyway, the thing that I told them about learning about shooting 35 versus shooting digital is that you learn what works and what doesn't work, like sink or swim with film. You know, if you do it wrong, you can't fix it, basically. And so you learn rules, and not even rules, whatever. It's the same way you build a house, you know. It's like if you put the bricks in here wrong, this place would fall down.
Right.
It's not, that's not a rule like be quiet in class. That's like that's like sensible. And it's what, and I equate it also with grammar.
Right.
So it's like, and the first example of that, which sounds really corny, is you can't probably be a very good poet if you aren't a really good, not at all.
Okay, fine.
You can't really be, not thanks, that's like, it would ruin the,
any other
it would
day,
ruin the wine.
Right. keep going.
I don't think you, I'm not very good at poetry or even appreciating it, but I don't think you can really probably be a really good poet unless you kind of live and breathe the language already. Like, you know everything about the language in order to mess with it.
Right.
So just, I apply that to film. Once you know why you did a close-up, once you know the grammar of a close-up, once you know the grammar of a wide lens, once you know the grammar of a hot backlight, once you know where a backlight's a punctuation mark, whatever. So then when you change that, you're doing it on purpose, not just because it looks cool. Because if it just looks cool, then you won't ever complete your sentences. You won't ever have a paragraph or any logic to your story.
Yeah.
You'll end up with all these punctuation marks.
Right. Well, let's
corny.
No, it's a phenomenal analogy. Can you apply that, since we're talking on a theoretical, we're going to get to the practical and some of the stuff you've done before, and I want to talk about that. But can you apply what you're talking about right now to how that affects cinematography in terms of cutting?
Yes. Well, they're completely 100% interrelated.
Right.
But they aren't, when I was talking about grammar, in order to edit something, again, you can't have, a whole bunch of, you have to have like stage lines and people looking left and looking right and motion, no motion, like really bright versus really dark doesn't cut well. You know, if you've got a shot with a lamp in it, that's the coolest shot you ever did, and then you cut to the shot of the other person and it's a gray background, then you cut back to this guy again, it's like there's just no connection.
Right.
So if you've got one shot that you're madly in love with and it has something to do with the contrast or the kind of lens you're using, you really need to consider that when you know there's films. The thing about films versus still photography is it's based on a series of shots. And that's the hardest thing to learn, I think, is you can't...
You're bound by time.
Sequence, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, like progression.
Any one photograph will not make a movie because it has to have another photograph after it in time,
yes,
and another one after that.
Yes.
So you can't, sometimes you go like, oh, it's like compromise, but it's not. It's just a brand new and really huge challenge to go from still photography / painting to, to an image, from an image to a sentence of images.
Right.
And that is really hard, and there are geniuses at that, and there are people who kind of, I feel like Wes Anderson almost is making a game out of it. It's like, I'm going to give you these wacky still shots, and I'm putting them together, therefore you have to put them together.
Right.
Like, no, they don't fit together, but they're really funny juxtaposed to each other.
Are you nice?
Versus another film where you might have, it just might glide from one shot to another, and you don't even remember what the shots were, you remember the whole scene.
So let's go back even further. Are you an Eisenstein?
Only through school.
Only through school.
Yes.
Okay. Because that, like, that was the big debate, that, you know, at the foundation of cinema, you know, in the 1920s, right. Was, are films built or are they collided? You know, is it just a layer? Is montage one thing after another that leads the audience down a path? Or is it more about, I'm going to show you one thing and show you another and then put them together, and by virtue of putting them together, I'm going to get something else?
I can't even imagine, like, how cool it would have been to be there at that time when that was really a question, because there wasn't enough you know, history or log of material to even base anything on.
Who are you, since you've made such beautiful images, you've made many, many beautiful Thank images you. Over the course of your
I made
life.
Seven, yes. No, I don't know.
You made seven of them, yeah. I mean, I think 21, actually. I can show you 21.
You.
Oh, okay. No, you made many, many, many beautiful images. Who would, when you first, I mean, nobody gets into this business because it was made economic sense. I don't care how crazy,
Absolutely.
How
no,
whacked
I wasn't
out,
even part of
you know, that. You know, if you're really crazy and you get into business and you find out how hard the business is, you end up on the street, and that's all there is to it, mm-hmm. and that's where you stay. If you have a lick's bit of sense, you go into something else, right?
Right.
And,
I agree.
And without a burning need to constantly wake up in the morning, I got to do this again. So, who before you knew that this was your path, who were the people that influenced you? Kid going to the theater.
Do you mean before I went to film school?
Yes.
Because before I went to film school, I didn't have a passion for filmmaking.
Oh, really?
No. I wanted a camera. Craft job. I was going to be an artist, a photographer, and I thought the only way I can do that is to get another, have a job.
So
I didn't even know that film school, literally, I didn't know film school would lead me into, what do you call it, theatrical filmmaking. That was the film school I went to, was completely geared toward theatrical filmmaking, not towards, like, how to be a cameraman, a sound man, a something. So I became the cinematographer in a director's school. Therefore, that's the kind of, it's almost like, what's it called, like imprinting?
Yep.
You know, like if I follow a duck, I become like a duck.
Yeah.
I learned everything I know about motion photography at a theatrical cinema film school.
Right.
That became my definition of being a cameraman.
Right, what photography was.
Yes, in cinematography.
So then,
movie photography.
So then, going back, who were your still photography idols when you were?
A guy named Emmett Gowan.
Uh-huh.
Who do you even know?
I don't know, but
phenomenal.
I'm not very.
Do you know who Sally Mann is?
No.
Okay. Well, Sally.
I can tell you.
Sally Mann's hero was like was Sally Mann, who's pretty famous now, and her hero was this guy Emmett Gowan, and I just stumbled across him, black and white. I mean, the famous people, Stieglitz, uh-huh. and Ansel Adams.
Yeah, of course.
When
you looked at Ansel Adams, what did you, was it just his attention? His
tireless? I think what I saw was how visceral black and white could be. Because my idea of a landscape, I didn't think in these things. These are like things I think now. But I don't think I ever saw a picture of a mountain or a plain that in black and white that made me feel like what it was like to be there. You know, I was used to calendars and like National Geographic and all that, and I'm like, this thing with the blackest black and the whitest white, that's a black and white picture, and I'm there, or I wish I was there. And it just blew me away, and I wanted to learn how to do, not to take that photo, but I wanted to learn that technique and apply it to whatever. I wanted to take pictures more of people and, like, I wanted to take pictures of, like, everyday mundane world and make them fascinating.
Walker Evans?
Yes. Yeah, Walker Evans, because you're exposed to him. Diane Arbus, yes and no, because I always felt that one thing I learned from still photography, and I don't know if I learned it, one thing I decided was that it's really easy to take a bad picture of a person by mistake. Like, you're trying to take a nice picture of a girl or a guy that's a friend of yours, and half the pictures, their eyes are blinking and mm-hmm. their face looks funny, and it doesn't describe them, it describes the act of taking that picture and how, what a weird, you know, it's a moment that you would never notice. You don't ever see me frozen with my eye half open.
Right.
But the camera does. And I always thought Diane Arbus, in a way, took advantage of the randomness of still photography to grab onto these moments to tell her story, which was about alienation and like people being screwed up and all that stuff. Anyway, so that was like, so Diane Arbus was a hero in one respect because she was so technically good, but she wasn't my style.
That's awesome. So, okay, but so
Joel Meyerowitz.
Yeah. So you have these influences. You go to film school. You de facto, you walk like a duck, and you go, oh. Which, by the way, is fascinating because that, what you're describing, what I intuited from what you said about this path, the theatrical means, they weren't telling you about, like, it was like, this is how you shoot a movie to cut a movie.
All
to play
all
a
once.
Movie in cinema.
All this at is, once.
And so the techniques, a lot of the things that they would be teaching would be, in some ways, rule-based, like you can't cut to this after you've shot that. But at the other hand, there are also fundamental things that a lot of filmmakers today don't have.
Absolutely.
Just don't have.
Absolutely.
Because they see YouTube and they see point of, you know, people putting cameras at themselves into this, into that, and cutting every 5 seconds. And they're so lost in the digits that they don't understand the ideas of visual language.
Exactly. I would say that the main thing that I ended up, I learned my craft, or the things that I used to actually shoot the movies, you know, like how bright a light needs to be, or you know, even like what lens basically will, what lens will get the scene done, and you know, we'll be creative once we've got the scene done, let's say. So I learned those things by practice. But while I was there, I took, there was a teacher there named Slavko Vorkopich, who edited for Eisenstein.
Seriously?
Yes, he was like 75, 80 years old in the 70s, okay? And he probably had trouble walking, but he still had his voice and his thing. And he taught us about editing. And it was like an editing elective class. It wasn't the editing class where you went and, you know, you had to learn all that stuff too.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was this guy who lectured, and somebody went, go to that guy. I don't know who Eisenstein was, but I'm like, yeah, okay, he's this old, and he's an old teacher, and I've been to college. I'm like, okay, whatever. And he starts showing us the most, he taught us the most subjective class that ended up teaching me rules that I then taught the directors that I worked with for the next few years, I swear. Like, I didn't really edit movies myself, but I learned so much from him, partly because it was, like, his entertainment wasn't, you know, he was really entertaining. He wasn't just this old stuffy guy, and he was referencing, like, everything you could ever think of, and he would show us, like, Godard films to show you, he has a rule about, nobody knew this stuff, like, if you're in a car and you're looking left and you're looking right, the background's going in two different directions. You got, there's like things like you need to cut to the front, let's say, so that it's neutral before it goes to the other side. It's like, okay, I'm all writing all this down, whatever. He said, look, I know, like, every movie you see is pretty much the grammar's correct. And then he found all these scenes from Godard movies where he had broken every rule on purpose, for humor and intellectual, but it's actually, they're really funny if you've just gone to film school because they're so fuck you film school. And he just took those moments to show us what he meant. And it was like, it burned into my brain.
Right.
It's like, that's what that means. So that's what that stupid rule is that everybody's always talking about.
Yeah.
He showed it to us with really cool examples.
Yeah.
And that class is probably the most valuable class as a cinematographer of films, of storytelling. As a cinematographer of storytelling movies, Vorkopich's editing class is probably like the most special thing I had.
It's beautiful. What the scene you reminded me of, I don't know which Godard film, and I'm embarrassed because
I probably don't.
So many,
got them all,
but there's a scene where Sam Fuller is in the movie, and he's in, I'm a director,
movie.
He's smoking a cigar, and then somebody walks out of frame, and the whole part, it's at a party, and there's like two people in every shot, and then all of a sudden he walks out of frame, and he walks into frame, and there's like 40 people right there. And he turns around and grabs a pie and throws it or something, and it hits a wall with nobody or something. It's,
yep.
It's like that kind of,
it makes
you
want to go back and see some of those movies.
I know. You're actually making me want to go back.
Oh, they're hilarious, especially if you like just start thinking, you know, they're fantastic if you're going to film school, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
because you're getting told this is right, this is right.
But that's fascinating because he, at this time, I mean, you're talking about a guy who, if he edited for Eisenstein, he was editing anywhere from the mid-late 20s, probably.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You know, all the way through to maybe the 40s at the latest.
Yeah, whatever, he is known as the first montage editor. Which I think I've
read. But they mean the real definition of montage, i.e. collision.
Yes. Like taking a shot of a train and putting it in the middle of a scene about two people talking.
Yes.
Stuff like that. That was him and Eisenstein.
Right. But the amazing thing is that he, with that background, was expressing admiration for a new wave filmmaker from the 60s.
Yes.
So that's somebody
who's just so smart.
So yeah, well,
you just got the feeling that the people like that aren't threatened by changes and differences.
Well, this is what this brings up because you've been shooting now for 30 years, 25.
Let's see, since 80, 32.
32 years, and a lot of people, young people who either even executives think that young people have an energy and that. You know, if you're older, you can't understand the news, you know. And it's, you know, there's a great moment of Bobcat Goldthwait being on The Tonight Show or some talk show. And he was describing that his daughter was saying, no, you don't get Tom Green, Dad. You don't get him. And he was like, eventually he said, honey, I lit The Tonight Show on fire. I get it. believe me, I get it. You know what I mean? Right? Like, I get it. And this is the thing that I, you know, is crying out. Like when I speak to venerated filmmakers, you know, there's nothing, there's no one frame edit you don't get. You know, I mean, you've lived through it, you've seen it, you've been there, you've done that. It's not that you can't see something new. It's just that the ideas are all rooted in something that's, you know, that's been tried or that, you know, can be relayed to something that's been tried. You know, I mean, you've seen phases come and go over the course of your career.
Yeah.
You know, even just in photography, never mind in cutting, but in photography, right? Yeah. Like, for example, Bleach Bypass.
Yes.
You know, Saving Private Ryan comes out.
Yep.
And
they did the shutter thing.
Yeah, the angles. Yeah, the angle. Instead of 180 degrees, they go 90 and 45 and 22. Yep. And are you being asked to do that on the jobs at that point?
Inevitably, yes. But Bleach Bypass, for specifically, is something. The first time I saw it, I was like. Looking for the movie, I'm looking for the director who wanted to do it because I loved it.
Okay, so I picked one thing. What are some other trends over the years that you've seen come and go that you've been phones ringing?
Oh boy, I don't know. I don't think of the perspective of things. It still seems like it's just I'm in the middle of it. You know what I mean? I remember the stuff before me, and I feel like everything since when I started. You know, let's say I started this little part of my life in the late 70s, and that was kind of at the time of, like Robert Altman.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say Robert Altman was peaking when I was going to film school. And, like, one of my first hero DPs was Robbie Mueller.
Yeah.
And so a director is Wim Wenders. So Wim Wenders and, you know, Kubrick.
Yeah.
And, Robert Altman. Robert Altman was one of my first heroes, not because of a film, although there were two films in a row. He came out with Nashville. Right afterwards, he made a movie called The Wedding or something like that.
Yeah, which was 48. And, so there's 24, was like 24 main characters in Nashville and 48 main characters in The Wedding.
Well, his sound guy, the guy who did his actual production sound, was this guy who was teaching at UCLA.
Right.
Named Richard Portman, and I think that's his name. But he's the one that had to mic everybody and just said, I can do it. And nobody had ever said yes to that before. So so people told you, go see these movies just for this. I don't care if you care about this or anything. And I just remember seeing The Wedding and going like, that's the first movie I've ever seen with my sense of humor. Or like, you know what I mean?
Wow.
It's like idiotic. It's totally idiotic. And I was like, I felt like I've always sometimes rambled into conversations with people, and then they just look at me like, what? And I saw that movie and went, I would understand him and he would understand me. Because it was a movie about absolutely nothing, but it was hilarious. And it's like nothing happens. But so I was fell in love with Robert Altman. Anyway, So there were styles of start, and I know one is what's it called? Like, people are asking me about it now. It's when you expose the film before you shoot it.
Oh, pre-flashing.
Flashing, yeah. Pre-flashing and post-flashing. And Vilma Zsigmon and I found this article from an AFI interview, because Vilma Zsigmon and Laszlo Kovacs had started doing that,
yeah,
and trying to get the look going.
Late 70s, right?
Yes. I think so, late 70s, early
80s. Yeah, and what was the film?
But the main movies, yeah, I remember was Deer Hunter and, yeah, McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Yeah, McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
I don't think Laszlo Kovacs actually bought into it too much, because he doesn't. I don't know which of his movies are, but Vilma Zsigmon, who's another one of my old heroes, McCabe and Mrs. Miller and Deer Hunter, where he did it, he said, totally trying to mess. The film was getting too perfect, and he wanted it to, yeah, be all messed up. Yeah. So anyway, those films, when you look at them now, they almost look like too primitive, or too much of one thing superimposed. I mean, the films are fantastic, but whereas like McCabe and Mrs. Miller was an older, that was like one of my films that I wanted to be able to do something that good. That was enough to drive me for a few years, if I could ever do anything that good. But then I saw it like 5 years ago, and I don't want to do that anymore. Like, that was then, you know what I mean? So the definitely heavy diffusion filters.
Yes.
Which, you know, there
were... It almost looks like as a Warren Beatty's face is being smeared across the,
yeah,
screen.
Yeah, and it's very... If you see it and you're in the right mood and it's loud sound and you go into it...
And you're stoned.
But if you're stepping... Yeah, probably. The first three times I saw it, anyway.
Yeah.
But then if you step back and watch it on your TV and you're like this... You'd go like, this isn't really like the way it looks. But if you're in a theater and like, I'm sure it's still totally seductive and fantastic.
Right.
And Leonard Cohen music. I wanted to be in part of a community like Robert Altman's filmmaking. That was probably one of my first absolute hero situations.
You're talking about...
Because I found out also that he used the same actors and the same crew over and over. And after doing about 15 student films, I started to realize one of the hardest things about it is relearning the language every time you had a new crew.
Right. Because every movie is a different story, different location, different
place.
Yeah,
but no, if I have a new gaffer or a new key grip or a new camera assistant... They have to get to know who I am and what I like to do
and all that stuff. Yeah,
and
yeah,
he would have the same people over and over and over again. So be like, hey, we're back on this one. Did you read this script? Let's go. Let's shoot. And it'd be like, that's how you make a movie. It seemed like to me anyway. That seemed like the best idea ever. And most of the directors, not most of them, but a lot of the directors who make films like Wes Anderson, he uses the same DP and the same production designer, therefore he's going to end up with the same.
Yeah,
therefore he's going to end up with this family of people.
Yeah,
and he obviously does it with the actors.
Love Bob Yeoman's work too, by the way. Big fan. It's interesting you say that, because what you're saying is that you basically got into this and fell in love and were driven by a passion for what's arguably the most experimental, rule-breaking, anti-establishment era the business of film has ever seen. Arguably the medium of film has ever seen. Arguably.
I don't think more than... Well, maybe it's similar to, but I'm just saying I don't really know the answer to this.
Yeah.
But certainly, I mean, for us, the French New Wave, it was...
But that's we're talking like, you know, Nashville 76, you know, Godard is starting in on, you know, he's only becoming an international sensation in the 60s.
Yes.
So it's
but
not...
But I think of the 60s is like...
Yeah, probably, I mean, the 60s...
That was before I had any idea what was going on, although you could see a Truffaut film.
You could see a Truffaut film, yeah.
And I
but
did,
early
actually...
But Truffaut isn't so nuts. I mean, Day and Night is not the same film as 400 Blows.
Right.
Day for Night, rather.
Right.
So, I mean, this is the most experimental...
Well, that's where we fell in, like I said, about following the duck or whatever. That's when we fell into it. Like, American Friend by Wim Wenders and...
Fabulous picture.
And McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Fabulous picture.
I'm trying to think what else were, like, those were probably the movies that I went, oh, now I'm interested. Now I think I could get into this. And another film that blew my mind was Five Easy Pieces with Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, yes, with Rafe's Bob Rafe.
Yeah, that's the idea. It's just a story of a messed up family.
Yeah.
It's so non-melodramatic. And I think there was this movie called Easy Rider that came out.
Easy Rider, little picture.
That was more like, almost like, for if you were there then.
Walkabout was
to
Walkabout.
To me, whenever Walkabout was, that was also, like, blew my mind. Just blew my mind. That was like Disney on acid.
Badlands,
yes. Yeah, I was in film school for Badlands. That movie depressed me so much that I had trouble appreciating it. There was something about him knowing that he was dead. Once, you know, kills people, okay. But then it's just that run, the romantic run out forever for most of the movie. And it's like, I just couldn't stop feeling that he's just dead, no matter, he's like, don't like him, don't get to like him, he's dead.
So a lot of these
films... So that movie really, like, that was, like, creepy to me. It was beautiful, but creepy.
A lot of these films are sort of, like, raw...
Antonioni.
Well, yeah.
No, I'm just thinking Blow Up.
Blow Up, yeah.
Blow Up I saw before film school, and that probably was one of the mind-blowing...
Changed your life.
By myself, you know, not me and my friends, me.
Well, you especially, because of the fact that you were still a photographer.
Yeah, I went like, I'm not short, but it was like the fact that he had a 6'4" model girlfriend, and he's like 5'6", and he's a photographer, and it was like the British invasion music, which also, that's probably as big of an influence on my life as anything, is from the Beatles up through the Yardbirds and Small Faces, and era of music.
Let's talk about Blow Up for a second. In the sequence where the photographer... Is he named in the movie? I forget if he's named.
Probably. I haven't seen the movie in a while.
Anyway, but in the sequence where he's actually starting to put it together, what's happened, and he's doing the blow-ups of the shot that he has, and then it's cutting between his memory and the blow-ups and the woman running away and all of these things, and then all of a sudden he starts to see that, wait a minute.
There's something in the picture.
So, what was the effect for you? I mean, at this point, you are a film student? I mean...
No.
No, you're not yet.
No.
Okay, fine.
But I am. I'm pretty sure I must have been in college because I knew how to develop film and I knew about, like, getting the picture come up and all that stuff.
So this probably hit you from all ends.
Yeah, but that was like I got the tool. I remember like I know his tool. It isn't exotic to me at all. His tool is the camera. You know what I mean? Right. And the camera worked for him, and I knew why and how and all that stuff. So I guess maybe I was able to identify him a little cooler than maybe a lot of people.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't think about it because I wasn't thinking of myself as going towards that as a career. All I thought about it was a movie, just like you read a novel. All it did was get me farther into the fun of that
storytelling.
But I have like this weird like subjective memories. Like I can tell you right now. Did you ever see The Omen?
The original.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that movie and Blow Up both have shots of people killing people driving loud motorcycles.
This is nothing. Yesterday we were doing an interview, and literally over half the interview,
one of my biggest pet peeves in the city, where, you know, trucks have to drive, and they're trucks, and they're delivering things. But the only people that go out of their way to make noise is a certain group of motorcycle riders. And those people, I just want to spit on them.
Have you ever done it?
I've ridden a motorcycle, but not with a big because they could get off too easily, and also that'd be hard, and I don't spit that well. I have kicked cars and things that are like, don't go stop at stop signs.
I would not want to see you throw a fit on set. I would think you're focused and you're there, and you could probably even witness insanity happening in front of you and be fine with it.
Yeah,
because you're sensitive to that.
Yeah,
but then things could be going normally, and somebody could just rub you the wrong way 3 times. Nobody knows that they're rubbing you the wrong way 3 times, and then, bam, the 4th time, Tom Richmond, grabs a 35mm, and it's across the room.
I try to do things like throw sandwiches and, things that are not, like, throw my coffee if I'm going to do that.
Have you ever fired people?
No.
Never fired people?
I think I might have had to fire a few people, either for a purely technical reason, mostly for purely technical reasons. There's somebody I let go because of personality, but I finished a film and just didn't hire him after that. but and then the technical reasons related to pressure from above, whereas before I could maybe get this guy to do a little better at what they were doing. And I don't want to, and I don't like to. It's like casting. You just try to cast the right people before a job starts, so you don't find yourself. This is not necessarily the same thing, but it's cool to just drop it in there. The director, Todd Solondz, Happiness and stuff. I did Palindromes for him. But he said something, because I asked him, because his movies are just completely performance-driven, 100%. It's like you shoot them, he wants them sort of shot, I'm presumptuous to say this, but a little bit like a TV show in the sense that I don't want you to worry about what the camera's going to do, just pay attention.
Yes.
Right? So maybe that's my interpretation. So the result was that he wanted the photography to never distract from the story. But anyway, so I asked him one day, and he told me, you know, like he had all his influences and things like that. But I asked him about casting, because he is like, you know, how do you choose people that can perform in your movies and feel good about them? And then, like, how much rehearsal do you do? And he was like, no, I don't rehearse. I it's all in the casting.
Yeah.
I cast the people that are those characters, and then I don't rehearse. And he was like, I don't rehearse.
And I'm not sure how Dylan Baker would feel about that, given that he was cast as a pedophile. And one of the scariest pedophile ever.
That movie is one of the scariest movies for you to have happen to you as an audience, because you're just having the best time ever, and then you feel like, what am I laughing about? Who am I? This is horrible. I know so many people got mad at that movie because I feel like they feel like they were tricked.
I think the reason why it works so well is because you see him behaving. His the end game for what he wants is not what you or I want or anybody else that we think we know wants.
Mm-hmm.
But the way in which he went about trying to get it,
you can relate
familiar.
To.
You
yes,
really,
yes.
He gets a magazine. He sits down in the back of his car. He can't help it. He's got these. He's thinking about it on his job. He's trying to.
No, that's a really wealth. Well.
Well, I'm just...
I agree with you completely.
You know, and so you relate to that, and then and you sort of relate to everyone in the movie, and then I think by the end, when the dog, that's when it's kind of like, I guess. Yeah. But tell us about Palindrome. I mean, you're obviously a very generous spirit, because only a generous spirit would be so interested in talking about other people's films. I want to talk about your film for a bit. Palindromes. Todd Solondz, I mean, you must have been rocked to, I mean, if this is the generation that your influences and you grew up with, and your tastes have obviously evolved through the years, but nobody doesn't want to make a Todd Solondz movie.
Correct.
You know, I mean, if not... Especially,
that's correct. He had done I only knew him from Welcome to the Dollhouse, which was, to me, the beginning of a new filmmaker. And it was just one of those movies back there. And then... But I, for some reason, I knew him better than... I knew he was, like, somebody really special. I probably heard more about him. I'm not sure. Because out of the blue, I got this script called Happiness. And was just... I just remember sitting in my room, and I started reading this thing. And I got about halfway through, and I was just laughing. And then it went... And so I read the script, and I went, oh, my God. Like, I want to shoot this. And how did... I'm so happy I got the script. And how does he even... I'm proud that he knows who I am. You get like a dollar to make a Todd Solondz film. They don't have any money,
right?
I didn't care at all. It was like, to me, this is like art history,
right?
And so I went to this is an exact sequence, but first of all, I guess here's the first thing I thought when I read it is like, great, I'm gonna tell my agent that I'm totally interested in this film, and then I'm gonna forget about it because they'll never make it. This film, I didn't think it would get made. And there wasn't in the climate at that time, which wasn't A or B, but it wasn't anything. And it just, I felt like this is one of those things, he'll make it on his own someday. And you get lots of scripts when you're, you know, a DP that half of them get made and half of them don't.
Right.
They're trying to get interest.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I sort of forgot about it. I mean, I was aware of it, but I forgot about it. I knew Todd Solondz was from New York. I was living in L.A., and a friend of mine called me out of the blue and went, he had done a Park, what's it called? Sundance. The Sundance Summer Workshop for a director who had, they do a little part of a film. And she had gotten the money to make the film, and he couldn't shoot it because he didn't have enough experience, and he wanted to highly recommend me. So he did, and I followed up, and I was using his whatever. I kind of almost barged into these people's lives and said, I want an interview. Anyway, they already had a DP, but the DP was a friend of the director's, not necessarily the best DP of the world. And not that I am, but I was quite experienced at this time.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this is like parallel to happiness. So I went to New York to meet this person, and that person is Tamara Jenkins, who directed Slums of Beverly Hills.
Yep.
And the movie was Slums of Beverly Hills. So I had this meeting with her, and I guess I was as good as I could get, which I've not always been in terms of interviewing.
Yeah.
But I could tell, like, she was very reluctant when she first met me. And by the end, late that night, I think, they hired me. Like, it was like, I loved the movie. The script was unbelievable. I couldn't believe it.
What are the sequences that when you watch them...
Wait, kind of, just let me finish.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, so that, anyway, that night, I really quickly, I got that job. While I was still in the city, I got a call from my agent and said, can you have lunch with Todd Solondz tomorrow? And I was still like, cool, yeah, sure, I'm in New York, why not? And we're sitting outside eating, and he goes like, well, do you want to shoot my movie? And I was like, what? Are you making that movie that I read? Yeah, and we're starting, and he gave a date, and it was like 2 days away from the other one.
And you were already committed to...
And I already committed to the other one, which was about four times the budget, which still wasn't much, but it was like a good little Hollywood job with Marissa Tomei and like, you know, it was like... But anyway, it's like, I had just... And also, I had sort of turned the almost turned the tables on the people from Slums to get that job. I was in no position to be able to call them and go like, I don't want your job. Because I went, you know what I mean? And this, I'm thinking it was probably more than a day. It probably wasn't the next day. It was probably 2 or 3 days. It was enough that it was secured. I got this job. But anyway, I'm like, this is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. This guy's asking me to shoot Happiness, and they're actually... I was like, that's it. Todd Solondz works with a DP once, and then that's it. So I'm screwed. That's the end of that. Anyway, that's all leading up to the fact that, you know, about a year and a half later, 2 years later, he called and said, do I want to shoot Palindromes?
Now... If he works with somebody once, so he's made films since Palindromes.
Yes.
I'm just curious, why only one film with...
I'm not positive if you would have to look back, but all I remember is, like, you know, I don't remember who shot Welcome to the Dollhouse, but a woman named Maurice Alberti, who shot The Wrestler,
yes,
shot Happiness.
Yeah.
And then I shot Palindromes, or actually before that there was a movie that's a whole bunch of vignettes
that
Fred Elms shot. He's a really renowned DP.
Yeah, Fred.
Okay.
He's from here too.
Yep. Well, he's a friend.
Yep.
And then so he shot that movie. So he's great. So you wouldn't not hire Fred again.
Right.
But he just didn't. He hired me. And then, like, his most recent film, I can't remember who goes in between, but he has a different DP for every film.
Well, so he does.
And I think what he's doing is just wanting to have himself take advantage of his position and get to have this exposure to all these different people.
You can't blame
him. I don't really know.
You can't blame
him. And he doesn't explain it. He never calls to say, like, oh, sorry, I'm not hiring you. So, because it's like, so, no, I don't blame him either. Especially once it got, like, two more past me and I realized they were all different. That's Todd and it's his prerogative, and why not?
Yeah, yeah.
It probably gives him new perspective.
Is there any particular sequence in both Slums of Beverly Hills that you are really fond of, and also Palindromes, or some from either of those?
Oh, dear. Yes, and yes. And though I would say I'm more of like, I wish I could tell you something from Palindromes, but off the top of my head, because I know there are things and I'll think of them later, but the thing that I liked the best was that basically the movies was planned to be mostly just static shots, and as is Happiness. But at one point, one of the producers came over to see me, like, you know, had dinner with me or something, and he went like, you know what? So we're halfway through the film. He said, this is weird. Todd wants to do, since he's met you, he's now he wants to do like little dolly shots and like he's your photography is like seducing him a little bit, because he's always been like, you know, don't mess with this camera stuff.
Yeah.
He said, I got from it was that I was able to, like, he got the feeling that I could do it within his parameters, that we could add something. So he wasn't making anti-production value. He just wanted it not to get in the way. And so something we were doing, which I wasn't even aware of, made him feel that it wasn't going to screw up his scene to add a dolly shot or change a little, do a little bit weird styly something in the photography. So the main thing I remember about that was that he wasn't, that I helped him sort of get, or took him somewhere where he got into like enjoying a little bit of specific
using the
style.
Camera.
Yeah. See, it's using the camera and the lighting.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said at the beginning about Todd Zalons that he said, you know, like, just don't let the camera interfere.
Yep.
You can make a wonderful movie like that. Don't you wish we had Martin Scorsese in the room to start referencing him and all of his contemporaries?
Yeah, sure. Oh, okay, well, there's some other, yeah, there was, when I was in film school also, there was this movie called Mean Streets that came out.
Well, yeah.
And that had an effect, and, yeah, so, I mean, literally, yeah, you were talking about, like, what was going on.
No, but
when I think about
no,
it.
No, but as far, like, as the Salon's experience goes, what's interesting is, like, he puts the cameras there, it says, don't get in the way. But one might say that you can use the exact opposite approach, and still end up with a similar, let me rephrase what I'm saying. Instead of saying, get the camera out of the way and just make sure it captures the action, you could say that you need that camera to tell the story. You need to use that camera to tell the story. That camera, you can't, it's like saying, you know, by the way, read me the book, but just read me the book from the next room. Because I don't want to see you. I don't want, you know, I just want to hear your voice. Well, you'll hear my voice a lot clearer if we acknowledge the fact that I'm in the room. And,
if
you want, we can close our eyes. But, you know, I'm just...
Yeah, but I think I know what you mean. Just, there was no need to, need to address that with him, though. He just sort of, I often was confident enough of what I could do that I could just agree with whatever he wanted to do, and then, you know, and that wouldn't, also it wasn't my movie, it was his movie.
Of course.
So I wouldn't want to have said yes to something that would sabotage what I could do, and he never put me in that position.
That's wonderful.
We found, and something, in fact, the opposite happened, whereas he wanted to try more stuff by the end of the film.
That's
what I meant.
That's fabulous. And so you gave him the freedom to use the camera if it wasn't.
Not on purpose, but that's what happened. That's what the producer told me.
And how did you find that working relationship over the course of the...
Well, it was a good... I mean, he's a unique person, and it's the hardest thing is sort of like, you can't help it, like, I couldn't help it anyway. I always think of DP, director of photography, as detective of photography. Because people... you work with these people that you've never really gotten to know very well till you work on the movie, and everybody speaks a different language, and so they say something but they mean something else, or they say something and they only said a third of it, so they meant to just go over there, and what they really meant was, like, if you'd seen my other films and you knew, like, I would usually shoot 3/4 angles and, like, I like it dark in the background, so you know what I mean? So with Todd, I...
Detective photography.
Yeah, so you start asking questions that aren't invasive, trying to figure out what somebody really means when they say it, so that you don't have to do it when you're shooting.
Right.
Anyway, he was one of those people that I was trying to learn. You also can bite, you know, it's like kind of what you were saying about, like, you have to admit the camera's in the room, it'll probably end up saving you some time if I don't have to come around the corner every time and talk to you.
Yeah.
So it was one of those kind of things where I didn't want to not... If you don't say anything, if no matter what Todd said, I just go, yes, then halfway through every day I would have not really known what to do. So you do try to figure out, despite no matter what somebody's personality is or relationship to you, you've got... Your job as a DP is to figure out a whole ton of what they want before any given day of shooting. Like, you don't want to go in there and at the end of the day goes, he's so confusing, that director. Like, then you screwed up. Your job is to get the film shot, not to talk about your critique of what the people around you was. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah. Well, no,
so there's
that,
no there's
that's a big one. That's
there
big
is
one.
No rules that they never teach a DP that you have to get to know the director inside and out and know that when he says this, he actually means that, and you have to know that this actress doesn't like it when you get really close to the light meter, all that kind of stuff. Like, that's not written down, and you don't go up during a screening of a film and go, hey, I know this scene looks funny, but it's because this actor doesn't like this kind of light. Sorry, I'll just sit down now. Keep watching the movie. That never happens. Like, no matter what happens, you have to get it shot and as uncompromisingly as possible. So there's all these little weird things, and I just call it detective of photography, which is like...
That's interesting. Have you ever seen Paul Schrader's analysis of Pickpocket?
No.
I was just talking about this the other day with somebody else, how he talks about how in a normal... Paul Schrader said he saw a Pickpocket and he couldn't stop thinking about it for weeks. You know, like for 2 weeks. And so he wrote about it because he couldn't think of anything else to do but write about it. But, for example, one of the examples he uses is, typically if somebody's walking through a door, you'll cut 8 to 10 frames as they're approaching the door, and then 8 to 10 frames after they've left, as a typical, it is old school.
Sure, I'm just listening, though.
You know, nowadays it would be 56 frames, and we would show one step of him, and then we would cut to him stabbing himself in the face or something. But and then make sure you flash to 3 other frames of some woman's scary face in the middle, and and in this movie, in Pickpocket, he did the opposite. Somebody would walk into a door and open the door and walk in, and it would cut to the shot of the other side of the door. The door's still closed. And then it would open. Just enough to make you feel uncomfortable.
Wow.
And it's like, why is he doing that?
Yeah.
And the most exciting action in the movie happens off camera. The pickpocket walks off and the cops show up to him and it fades out. Cut to jail.
Yeah.
So Bresson was the biggest influence on Stallone.
Right, and that fits perfectly because he didn't try to make Bresson movies.
Yeah.
But just what you described, that fits perfectly with what I think. He was trying to. What he tries to do, I think he's changed a lot. Actually, the last couple of films I've seen are more like visual. They're more he's taking the camera, using the camera and the lighting, I think, a little differently. But in like at least his pictures, it's sort of like here's your frame. If you don't like this frame, you can leave because this is all you're getting. And now I'll do my movie within that frame.
Right.
And I think he was definitely like
it's like a proscenium almost.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, it's like, and it isn't like spitting on film because it's going like, I have to have a theater and I have to have a camera. But within that, now, don't look for flash here. Don't look for any seduction. I'm going to tell you a story that's the story in my head. And these actors aren't going to, we're not going to dolly into them. We're not going to, you better just like watch this. And if you like it, great. If you don't, too bad.
Okay,
so that was that. So
going back a bit, you shot.
I didn't tell. I'm trying to think if there's Slums has so many things that I loved in it that I do thought were really clever, and now of course I can't remember any of them. Like things that we did do some visual stuff in that movie that was really fun, but now I can't remember it. So don't put that in there.
Not death. You shot one of my... Okay, so I'm going to name 3 films of yours from the scope of time from 1988 to 1993. 5-year span. Okay, I'm just going to name the 3 films. I'm going to tell you why I'm naming them. Stand and Deliver. Edward James Olmos. Giving a tour de force performance that most people don't realize. You can hold that performance up against Emma Thompson in Sense and Sensibility. You can hold it up against Jack Nicholson in 5 Easy Pieces. You can hold it up against anything, right? I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker. One of the first blaxploitation farce, Zucker Brothers style spoof movie. Killing Zoe, Roger Avery's independent film breaking away from the Tarantino days and making his own movie.
None of these movies bears one resemblance to the next. Not one resemblance. Even if you ask me who shot I'm Gonna Get You Sucker, I'd be like, it was the guy that shot name a kid's movie from that movie, a family movie, something. Wouldn't have for a second thought the lensing, the lighting, the style.
Right.
Never mind palindromes. I'm saying within a 5-year period.
Yeah.
This is like you putting on masks. How do you do that? Was it just that you approached? Are you conscious of it, or are you just letting?
There's definitely like that is interesting and descriptive. I don't know if that molded what I sort of turned into, or that was me that made those different. Like, I don't know which came first, the chicken or the whatever it is, but. Basically, that was the very beginning of. I think Stand and Deliver is my third real film.
Okay.
You did shoot
Shut Hard Bodies too. I mean, let's not.
Correct. But isn't before that? I believe is Straight to Hell and Chocolate War.
Yep, Chocolate War was okay. Chocolate War.
Was that before or after Stand and Deliver?
Chocolate War was right after.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, same year.
No, okay, but no, that's important. Okay. So I'd really only done Straight to Hell before I did. But the other movies were like just this other. They were like film school, bad film school. Like there was good film school, and then I had to start paying my dues, and that lasted much longer than I almost forgot what I was doing, and I was just doing these movies that weren't fun to do at all. And then Alex Cox came along, and we, out of the blue, just decided to. This movie just generated itself, Straight to Hell. And I only mention that because that was it. Like woke me up. It was like somebody throwing water on my head, and going like, "What are you doing? Do you remember what you do and why you're here?" And it's because I'm a good photographer. And we went to this spaghetti western, old falling apart spaghetti western town from an old Charles Bronson movie, and just made this silly movie, but every shot is great. And I went like, this is what I do. And it was like an art movie, kind of. I mean, it's the kind of movie that people look at it and they go like, well, silly movie, but really interesting and really, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's like in the Alex Cox, what's it called, Vin, whatever you call a group of films by somebody, whatever that is, like that's a very interesting like little film. So anyway, that turned me from trying to please a bad B audience on TV to like to think this was scary or think it's TNA, to making a movie that we didn't care if anybody liked as long as we liked it. And I went like, wake up, that's what I want to do from now on, period. Those movies followed that. That was the next movie, which is also I mean, it took them or didn't take them. Stand and Deliver was friends of mine directing. We had very little money, and I really still had not learned a ton about lighting. And
you made 4 or 5 pictures.
I just felt like my lighting was like, you know, was okay. I mean, until I just had never become. I feel like if I'd focused on horror, maybe I would have learned a whole bunch of lighting tricks.
What's more important, framing or lighting?
What do I like?
Yeah.
What I like is composition. And I come from, I think I learned compositions, things and their interrelationship visually. Like, just when I walked down here, I'm so glad I didn't take the subway because I saw like about 500 photographs. I didn't shoot them, but they entertained me like a free movie almost. And I take pictures sometimes like that and just click, 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 click. And I get home and a couple of them catch my eye, and most of them I remember why I thought it was interesting, but it doesn't work. And mostly it's because of lighting / depth. Like, just saying. Like, yep. Occasionally you can take a flat picture and it's so interesting that it works. But as soon as you add either depth, which causes you to go to look into a picture or to be stopped right at the front of a picture, or you add black. I feel like if you have white, you gotta have black. unless it's a really all white picture, like the beginning of Close Encounters of a Third Kind, which is one of the coolest beginnings of any movie in history ever. And it starts out with white noise and a white screen, and you don't even know it's white noise. It seems like there's something wrong, and the picture is just all doing this. And it turns out it's these guys in a sandstorm, and you gradually can hear them yelling over the wind, and then you gradually see that they found this airplane.
Or the opening, but you're sitting there, or the opening of Fargo.
I've forgotten.
Well, it's just a white wall, and then all of a sudden this car emerges, this sedan emerges, towing another sedan, and sort of drives right past
like that. So there's the exception where you're playing completely off of what appears to be flat white nothing.
Yes.
So anyway, but depth and color and contrast, black and white contrast. And anyway, so
have you made any films in black and white?
Only parts of a film.
Would you like to make a film?
More than anything. I think it's phenomenal, and I'm in love with so many black and white films, you know, modern black and white films. I think most of them are totally successful. And my favorite examples maybe would be Manhattan and Paper Moon.
Yes.
And when it came out, Raging Bull.
Yes.
In retrospect, I think I like Paper Moon and Manhattan better. I feel like they're more. I like the lighting and the use of light better. And I almost feel like Raging Bull, you could be color or black and white. It's like for the story, the black and white's very powerful, but the actual lighting style didn't really embrace black and white at all. It almost looks like television that's been cinemafied.
Yeah,
I don't even mean that as a critique, really. No, and the fighting footage is phenomenal.
Yeah,
but if you look at if you're trying, yes, true. It's amazing.
Yeah,
but it's really fun to read about how they shot that and how they analyzed the shit out of before they shot it, trying to figure out a wonderful visceral way to make that work.
Ramping and all that.
Yeah, but I shot I had my little, you know, in the late '80s, early '90s, I had my music video run. And did one of like the top famous videos of all time.
Which was?
Jeremy by Pearl Jam.
You did that video? Mm-hmm. So my only exposure to music videos is that basically in Canada, you know, when they're doing music videos, they always have a reference. We're going to make it look like that. Mm-hmm. You know, which in many ways music videos can be great.
I would say 90% of the videos I did were that.
Yeah. And I mean, there's something great about doing music videos because continuity is not an issue, never an issue. They're genuinely just montage to music.
Yep.
And on top of that, it's simple enough that you can pick one style one day, try it out, see what happens, get it done.
Or three styles
in one day. Yeah. I mean,
because the director isn't sure which one he really likes. And then you have to shoot the band.
Even
though it doesn't fit in at all.
Right.
But Jeremy was unique. Jeremy was like a movie.
I think the best music video I've ever seen is it's not Moby. What's his name? It was a Spike Jones video for. Fuck! I'm gonna be so embarrassed. I can't remember the name of the artist.
He's a
one man guy. I wanna praise you like a.
That's Moby.
That's Moby, okay.
I don't know if I've seen a Moby.
And all he did was he went to a mall with a handheld video camera. I mean high eight.
Mm-hmm.
And shot this group of losers. I mean, just like 30 to 45 year old losers dancing to it, like doing like a structured dance presentation to this
Not
song.
Not a very good one.
Terrible, in front of a crowd. From about, you know, three or four angles. And they're so into it. Right? They're just flopping around.
Sounds great.
And I don't know, I have no idea if it was staged, if it was actually, like, something polished, made to look idiotic, or it was just, he found them and said, you know, didn't tell them, or he had them rehearse and pick people who couldn't dance and then said, we're going to go do this in public, and this is going to be great, you know, whatever. But it just, your eye... This is what happens. Your eye is waiting in this video. Your eye is waiting for all of a sudden, like sepia to warm over, and then all of a sudden them to like emerge, you know, like a splash of color, and then they're on stage lit, and
right, and then seeing, maybe Moby shows up,
and then maybe Moby shows up, and we're seeing the real thing, right, as right. opposed to the
never does.
Never happens, yeah, it just keeps on playing out worse to worse.
That's
to worse.
Great,
yeah, and I mean, like I grew up in my father's audio video store, and you know, there's 15 screens
yes.
in the high end video section, right, and all of us were just watching this video. And couldn't stop watching it because the minute it didn't happen, the second it didn't make that shift into something polished and beautiful and nice and whatever, you kept on wondering, what's going to happen next? And of course, what happened next is that they just became bigger and bigger fools and something.
Yeah,
bigger idiots. Great. It was great. Anyway, okay, we have to get to talking about, I mean, I've talked to you about
we didn't. Do you want to just really quickly finish to that the one thing you had, which was Stand and Deliver, Sucker, and...
I want to talk about those.
Oh.
Yeah, so Stand and Deliver, just tell us about the heart attack.
Oh, okay. The shot?
Going down the steps, yeah.
The shot that we did, or yeah. The heart attack, that's like that was like the biggest production value in the movie. Like that movie, the idea of it, I'll just tell you really quickly because to pinpoint that shot, is the idea of the movie is that there's no point in making a movie where you highlight the classroom because the idea is that there's this one teacher. Who every student in the world has been in this classroom. It's about the teacher, not the classroom. Therefore, we made the classrooms completely mundane. And so, and what we did is we thought the way to keep the audience from falling asleep or to go that route of Robert Bresson or something to not do that was Eddie Olmos would create with us a way of dollying and moving through the kids so that instead of cuts, we intentionally made a few scenes that are cuts in him. And the rest of the scenes are he's wandering through the class. It was like a play. So it was like a play in a boring environment. The most boring environment. We didn't even have windows. We had things that covered the windows. Like there was no input whatsoever. And so it all came from him. Blah, blah, blah. So that was the...
You were shooting on a film stock on like a...
Yeah, we were shooting on the fastest speed stock there was at the time. Which 200. Was probably like... I think it might have been 400.
400.
Yeah, around that time they started to have sort of high-speed stocks.
I love the fact that, you know, like, in the 60s it was like, if you got 100, that was like a miracle. That's what it is.
When I was going to film school, they had ASA 25 and ASA 50 and ASA 100, and I had to try to learn to light a little bit for those things, but by the time 25. I finished... Yeah, ECO... There was ASA 25, and there's some movie that was lit. The guy chose to use it on a feature with all these giant sets, and he did it because it was so gorgeous looking. But it was like I went to visit that set. It was it was ridiculous. It was like 200 degrees. It was before HMIs and stuff. But so anyway, in Stand and Deliver, the idea was that there was no obvious like beautiful camera move. Flow or lighting or in environmental beauty, or so we tried to bring some life into whenever you went home to the people's houses and make them really warm and friendly, even though the kids were all poor and blah blah blah. But then, so the idea was that, you know, a huge part about this movie is that this guy has a heart attack. So the director really wanted to do something a little like cinematic with that scene. So basically, he also didn't want any cuts. So there's this thing called a barber baby boom, which could fit in a, you know, you build it and put the camera on the end, and then you operated it, I think, from the camera. I've forgotten. I don't think it had wheels or anything on it. But the idea was, in one shot, he was supposed to come down the stairs, and Eddie, almost not a stunt guy, had to fall down, roll over, and end up on the floor. And so the trick was, first of all, I mean, it wasn't easy actually to light that, because like, I can't even remember now. It's like, because he goes, you know, how do you do dramatic lighting in that environment and not have the camera make a shadow at some point in your shot? And that took a while. But then also, I hadn't really used that tool before, so. And
you were operating?
Yeah. Yeah, I always operated up until a movie called Hardball, which was just a big studio movie, and they wouldn't let me operate. But But so I had to operate that. I mean, I could have probably tried to find somebody who was better at that than me, and that's what I have done in the, you know, from Hardball on, I started to go like, maybe there's somebody who's good at this exact thing. Let me look around and see. And sort of, you know, coming along with Steadicam and stuff, when nobody operates Steadicam except Steadicam guys, so you get used to the idea there's a specialist. Up until then, I sort of did somehow you do it all yourself, and you don't even think of getting somebody else. So that was the case in that one. So anyway, that was, and it came out, what it came out as is it still didn't call it, the camera did like four things, like getting, it had to, it starts out like around in a normal shot, and then it starts to get lower and lower and lower as he comes down the stairs, and then he just starts to touch his arm. So we're telling you that maybe, because the camera goes low, that maybe something bad might happen. But then he falls like sort of almost into the camera, and then I had to get away and end up like right down on the floor with him. And I don't remember how many takes it took, but it was a little like a mini stunt in that he could get hurt. They were just, we didn't have any special stuff for him to fall on because you saw the whole thing. So I knew I couldn't do too many takes. So that was a huge deal because that's a serious movie. It wasn't like one of those sets where you're running around laughing and having a good time, or here comes the big stunt scene or whatever. It was like...
And so, when you got it and you had the take, what was the... What did you go through seeing that happen? I mean, I'm not,
for me, I was just relief because it was so technically difficult, and I was so, we were all, I mean, Eddie almost actually was more of a family person. He was part of your family, but he was also an amazing actor, and you knew he was doing something a little bit risky, really. He also had like a toupee, so like I suppose he could have like hurt, you know. There was a million, it was taking something that was all pure drama and had to be technically correct. Like, and the technically correct part was really hard for me. So, and if you see this scene, you'd be like, oh yeah, it's sort of a cool shot. It isn't like, oh my God, how did they do that?
Right.
But it totally...
But it is the most gravitas-laden moment in the movie.
Yes.
You may not notice the technique, but you notice a tremendous performance from
absolutely, and it's uninterrupted. It's a single take, and it had to be. It didn't. We chose for it to be, and unlike Mean Streets or something, we could have come. What the director didn't want to do was go like, "Here's the gritty moment," you know. We wanted to not sell that at all. We wanted it to just appear to be the next shot in the movie, and then have it turn into something completely else. Which the only way to do that was to move the camera in a way that it couldn't. It was actually, it could have been done on a Steadicam, but there wasn't a Steadicam. So maybe The Shining, it was right around the time The Shining was made, probably. So, but Steadicam wasn't even a possibility. So there was this tool, we finally found the thing that could probably do what we wanted. But it was a big moment because it was such a performance moment where the camera had to just be 100% slave to the performance, and yet the shot was tricky. So usually it's sort of one or the other. It's like, sorry actor, we've got this shot where you've got to go up the stairs and out the window and everything, but like, just, you know, don't get too hardcore about it because you don't have to act. So that was a kind of a unique shot.
I'm going to get you, sucker. Probably watched it 20 times. Okay? I would tend to think, making this movie, that it's very nerve-wracking to think, you know, how do I get the tone? Because comedies, I mean, there's, you know...
It was scary.
Everything goes, you know, in phases. Comedies are, you know, literally, I remember when my partner and I were first out pitching pictures 10 years ago, or, no, that's not even, like, eight, nine years ago. It was like, nobody does comedies. And then... economy changed, everything went to hell, and then all of a sudden everyone wanted comedies, right? This is a spoof. You're making fun of a genre of films. You're by the way, I'm just going to take the opportunity right now to say, we took a break, we came back, that's why Tom's coat is on now.
Oh.
Yeah. I just noticed it too. He had his glasses off for a sec too.
In case everyone wants to know. No, his glasses have been off.
Yeah.
No. Anyway, so
we've been here for 3 days.
Welcome. We have food. If you have water, please bring it to us. Anyway, all we have is wine. Kosher wine. Anyway, there was a time when comedies are in, comedies go out. They do these things. Comedies were
in the early 80s, but it wasn't so much a slam dunk. It was, you know, you had to be doing it right, whatever right meant.
Right.
And here you have a spoof movie from a black writer-director who I think has some name in show business by virtue of the fact that he's been, you know, developing a New York street name or a Los Angeles street
name. Yeah, he had a TV show. Or
Living Color came after.
Oh, that's after. Yeah. Right, no, it came out of that. That's correct, because that has a lot of the same actors.
But there's
a guy named Robert Townsend who did a movie. This is what I do remember. Robert Townsend had made a movie like about a year before about an actor trying to get a job, and he's a black actor.
Robert Townsend, writer of Chinatown.
No, okay. Robert Townsend, a black comedian.
Okay.
And the other Robert Townsend.
The other Robert Townsend.
And I think it's Townsend. I'm pretty sure it's Robert. Anyway, but so he was like part of a gang of Keenan was like part of his group, and Keenan plays a dance, a ballet dance teacher or something in this movie that he made. And his movie was reasonably successful and very gentle compared to Sucker, but it was a film that was a comedy with black people in it. And it made a little bit of fun of black people, but gentle, like anybody could watch it. Anyway, he made enough money on that movie that he was like, I guess Keenan was like broiling in the background, stewing back there in a good way. I mean, like whatever, marinating, whatever. And he was like, good, I made enough money. Let's go, Keenan. We're making your movie. So that's what he was well known in this community of like up and coming black comedians, I guess. So that's what I know.
Best death ever. Jim Brown's death, I think, when he slips on the bullets. It's Jim Brown.
I thought it was very sad, yes.
Yeah. That's the best.
There were some tragic moments.
Best screen death ever. But I mean, you know, like the first thing you read in the movie is, you know, the cop coming up. Goddamn, over gold.
I know, over gold.
Looks like a fucking statue, right?
Yep.
You know, it's still saying, it's a nighttime, you're probably it's nervous.
That was one of the biggest lighting setups I've ever done. It was, do you remember? It starts with a crane shot coming into a city street. That scene is like a movie, it was like a scene from a big cop movie, and it ends up in this idiotic, like, little conversation about too much gold chains.
I know, but they unveil it, and you have to make it clear that there's a body of a black man covered in gold.
Yes. Which you just read it and think it's really funny, and then you're like, how do you actually film that?
Right.
It's
so how much light
nobody
you,
knew
how much light were you using in that shot with the crane shot and everything? Like, were you lights everywhere?
Oh, yeah. Maxi Brutes and Condors. And at the time, I think it was like a $4 million movie or something, which at that time was like at least like $10 million. You know, what you could get for that amount of money.
Significant
you
say budget. That.
Yeah, it's totally a reasonable budget. And it was enough money to be able to do one or two like big production value scenes. So that the thing that's funny is that scene, the big production is just purely to set it up. There's no chase or anything. But in order for that was the thing about that movie that was wonderful. In order to make this weird little things of humor work, you had to keep setting up genre type situations that you wouldn't laugh if we just cut to the close-ups of that and be like, so what? You have to feel that you're watching a movie that's like some horrible thing is about to occur or just occurred. And so, yeah, there's police cars, there's ambulances, we're in the city, and the camera comes booming down into the city, and then it's like, what? What is this scene about? This is ridiculous. But we had to sell that first. And I didn't have a ton of experience of that kind of situation. So that was a big lighting setup for me.
Overall, I mean, the movie is pretty much wall-to-wall black actors who are tough, you know, you need more light.
Yes.
Theoretically.
Theoretically. That's an interesting subject.
Do you think it's... please touch on it if you think that...
Well, I'll say really briefly, and it was a bit of an experiment, but I did two things in that movie that was not what had been done up until that point. And the movie is not a cinematic masterpiece by any means, and it was hard to shoot because it was a lot of comedy, and we had to... He was very much of a TV-oriented person in a sense of just shoot it. I want more takes, I want more performance. And so I was trying to light it as per why I got hired as a cinematographer of certain films. And I was like, uh-oh, that's not actually what he wanted. So trying to light film very fast for a bunch of black actors doing physical comedy and stuff was very challenging. But the thing that I concluded, when you weren't mixing like white characters and black characters, is that with a black skin, I've learned a lot of other things about shooting like darker skinned people since then. But black skin is darker than white skin. Therefore, it would look weird if you lit it to be the same value as a white person's skin. So I ended up, you just place it at a different place on the, this sounds horrible, but on the grayscale of white to black. Why it's darker. Well, I don't know, it's like putting people into grayscales. Oh, sure. But like, and black people also have like 11 different variations of skin tones, yeah. You know? So, and different colors. But the two things I mainly did was true, yeah. But although I find it's true. But, and that's a huge thing actually in general is color and skin tones and things people don't know, like that skin has tons of green in it. And that's not what we're talking about today. But,
you guys, right while you're talking, we're just going to cut to the two shot. We're going to Photoshop us both to look like the Hulk.
Excellent. That's I could use that. Yeah. Also, I want this to be in black and white because I don't like.
Yes.
Like, I just don't like red skin, and my skin's really red.
So you want this one to be in black and white?
Done. It'd be fantastic.
Done. Gladly.
Done.
Oh, thank you. That would be really cool. You'll like
looking. It'll look actually. It'll look really
yeah.
cool.
Yeah, like it will. quickly though, I chose. That I found, and I didn't take stills back then. They didn't have digital cameras. But I just felt that I could light the way I always liked, and maybe open up the f-stop a little bit. But in general, I didn't overlight them, and I didn't overlight this cast of insane comedians, and who was it? Bernie Casey was another one. He's another like. There's a joke in there about ex-football players. So we had Jim Brown and Bernie Casey, who are just like total football heroes of my childhood. And Bernie Casey came up to me one day and said, "Thank you, this is the first movie I've ever been in where the DP didn't put blue backlight." And what I did is like, it's sort of like there was this stupid stereotype that's all over those films that we were making fun of, where you light black people with blue backlight. It's just, you go back and look at them, all of them. It's like, oh, that's how they'll show up, they'll look cool. And he came up to me one day, I think he even shook my hand. He said, "Thank you so much for not using blue backlight." But the other thing I just found out is that just warm, I tended to use warmer lights, like warmer colors, and like various shades of brown skin tone just looks fucking gorgeous. So like, I don't think Keenan really cared if it was gorgeous looking, but everybody looked kind of wonderful.
They did. In the movie. They looked warm and...
And they didn't warm. Look like black characters had very much previously. And like I said, it's not a cinematic masterpiece by any means, and especially the blocking and stuff. We started to make the blocking simpler and simpler as the movie went on, so it does have a little bit of it, like a really beautiful but old TV show vibe to it.
Yeah.
Because he wanted to just be... have his actors be able to come out there not worrying about fancy blocking or dolly moves and be funny.
Yeah.
So we tried, you know, well, that was more what it ended up doing. But that said, the lighting, I think the characters all look kind of really attractive.
They do.
And even though it's supposed to be the dumbest comedy ever, it's cool that they look wonderful.
It's quite a beautiful movie, and I'm glad that this is what you're saying, because I remember it that way. I remember looking golden and a lot of, and there's even a sequence when they went out of the strip club. You know, that is love. That is getting laid. You know, that sequence. But even though those scenes, you know...
You remember when he orders a double Pepsi?
A double Pepsi. I'll have a double Pepsi. Yes. Very good. Okay, and then Killing Zoe.
Okay, we won't talk anymore about I'm Gonna Get You Sucker, even though... It was weird being the white DP on that movie, but I finally found my place when they were selling. We shot in George Jefferson's club, the Jefferson show. That guy owned a club, and that's where we shot the Pimp of the Year scene.
My hoe,
go give me my cash. I'll put my foot money. In ass. Right, 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 right,
right. Just give me my money.
Yeah, right, right, right.
So, so there was this big, that was another huge lighting setup, just because it was a big stage, and it took a long time, and there was I just told them, here's your eight things, and there was nothing to do for a while.
How much work was that for the costume designer to design all the hats?
Insane. Insane.
That's actually one of the most,
the big hat.
The big hat,
I don't know if you noticed, but the big hat club was called Whitey's.
Yes.
Okay, so anyway, going back now to the Jeffersons, I don't know which happened when, but that place, which was owned by George Jefferson's real wife, was in the lobby selling t-shirts while we were shooting, because she probably sells t-shirts at all the things, and I went, why not? They're making a film here, there's 80 people here, they'll buy shirts. And the shirt said, it's a black thing. Somebody was a black thing, I think, okay? Which had nothing to do with our movie, but it was, there I was, in kind of the white cool guy by that time, because it was just all inside black humor. Like, it was black people just being way out at the edge of what black humor was for black people at the time. I mean, Keenan Wayans is pushing a lot of buttons. Is it okay to laugh at this? And so, but I felt like I was in there. So there's this shirt, and I go, what a great souvenir for me. You know, to get this shirt it only means this, and I was the only guy here, whatever. I had a lot of white crew people, but I was sort of the only white guy in the main thing. And Keenan always, he's really, really big, and he would be sometimes pat my shoulder and go, Dom, come over here, let's talk about this. But anyway, I was sitting there looking at these t-shirts and looking at the t-shirts and going, I should get one. And they go, no, I'll go back to the West Side and I'll be so pretentious, it'll be so stupid. No, but when I'm hanging out in Hollywood and people ask me, it's really, no, I'm like, and then there was this there was this big clump on my shoulder and I just heard, give Whitey a t-shirt. And I looked up and Keenan was standing there. Keenan was staring at these t-shirts for, I guess, a long time, which I didn't realize I was doing, and there was this big clump on my back, and I looked around, and then this voice goes just give Whitey a t-shirt. This lady looks up, and I look, and it's Keenan Wayans, the director, and he's at that point, I was Whitey. It's I was now a member of the, and he just wanted me to get back to work and to get out of the lobby. So, but he said Whitey, and that was the first time. And so I just became Whitey, and then they had the bar called Whitey's, and I was once I became Whitey, it was all good. And I actually used that name from the Tom, as you know, and more now, 20 years ago, Tom's super common name. Now there's all these names, Trevor and Justin, and people have millions of different names. But when I was a kid, Dave, Tom, Bob, Joe, Bill, Mark. Anyway, there's always five Toms on a movie. So whenever I got on a movie, as soon as it started to get to know the people, if I found out there was more than one Tom,
I'd say
call me Whitey. And I was Whitey till 5 years ago.
That's the best story we've ever heard. I'm a white guy that shot a blaxploitation spoof movie.
Yeah, so it's really easy to explain.
Because that's what you call me.
If anybody ever asks.
Yeah, yeah. So I think I'd be Yid.
The third Yid?
Yid. Anyway, but that's very funny. Okay,
do you want to do the third movie of those three? Because I have one quick story.
Well, actually, what I realized we're going to have to do, let's do Killing Zoe, and then let's end it, and then we're going to have to do another, we're going to have to come back to New York and do more with you.
Oh.
It's fabulous, and we can, but I mean, this is really what I want, which is referencing other movies, and talking about other things, and going, and this is fabulous, but we have to limit our time. So, Killing Zoe almost had an aesthetic. It looked like it was trying to be low rent, very, very simple. With the exception of the tranced out drug, very long, very, very long drug up sequence.
Right.
But
too
from,
long.
Pardon me?
Too long.
No, I wouldn't say too long. The funny thing is that the reason why I saw the movie is because I was talking to another director about a project he wanted to do, and he said, we were talking about a script or something like that, and he said, have you seen Killing Zoe? And I said, no, it's one of these ones that I keep meaning to see I haven't seen. And he said, well, you gotta see it, because he goes to Paris, and he meets this girl, but then he loses the girl, and then he, he goes out with his buddies, and it's like there's a scene of him being drugged up, but it's like a minute. And then they go do the heist the next morning. But he specified it's like a minute.
Right.
So I went and watched this, and this goes on for like
yeah,
20 like, minutes. Yeah. It's like a 20-minute, you know.
Probably.
But I had a feeling. But it's a filmmaking technique or it's not a technique. It's a film with a sequence that certainly captures something that most other films don't dare to do, which is that those knights tend to feel a certain way, and we're trying to get used to these characters and develop a very different relationship with them before there's a breakdown the next day in the typical, you know, but you're the bad guy and I'm the good guy, and we got to go our separate ways here, and that's going to result in death, you know. So it's brilliant, but just aesthetically, I mean, is there a desire when you're making this movie, like, to like, yeah, I gotta find a way to fucking get this fucking can. I gotta, you know, frosted glass or something with a weird. I gotta find a way to make it crazy. You know, I mean.
You're talking about the drug part or the whole movie?
Well, first the drug part, and then for the rest of the movie, is there a desire to, you know, what was the approach to the lighting and shooting of the rest of the movie?
Right. Well, the first thing I'd say is that the movie is divided, was divided into slightly, like, some of the reasons, there was reasons for some of it, and others was just to try some things stylistically and see how they came out. But, and I don't know. Oh, okay. I don't know, like, what the reference was, but the first part when they are, basically these guys go, he meets, I forgot what his name is.
Eric Stoltz.
The hotel, okay, really quickly, the hotel where he goes to the hotel, he's in France. The idea is, like, this is a real French hotel, not a movie French hotel. A movie French hotel has chandeliers and gilt gold and runners along the carpets. A real modern French hotel, this is exactly what it looks like.
Yes.
So that, and it did, and we shot it kind of real square. Okay, and like Julie Delpy, I think, like, she's like a sex bomb. She's fantastic.
She's gorgeous.
But she's still within this, like, kind of formal environment. And then the next thing is he goes to their place, their attic-y place, and, right? It's,
well, I, yeah,
Jean Hugo
yes,
Glass
yes,
comes
up,
to get him,
from there, yes.
And they go to that place.
Yeah,
and
they meet the team.
Right. Zed is Eric Stoltz's name.
Zed.
I had a dream the other day, and Eric Stoltz was a travel agent. And I would tell Eric Stoltz that, and he would laugh. But it was really funny. It was like he was a super high-end travel agent. Like,
you
he
think
quit,
Eric Stoltz
he quit would, making films.
Would Eric Stoltz book a flight for you? Do you think he would do that?
He was sort of trying, but he was really busy.
No, I'm saying in real life, would he do that if he was asked?
Yes.
He would?
He did an imitation of me that was incredible.
You know what? I could totally see that.
I was, first of all, so completely flattered that he bothered to do an imitation of me, but then also it was really good.
It was
and
really
I,
good.
Yeah, and I don't know what I'm like, but when I saw him,
you
I was
saw
like,
that, you
that's,
were like, that's me.
That's, yeah, that's it. It was, people were laughing. It was really funny. I walked into a room. They were waiting to start some dailies. So I wasn't in his audience. I walked in it, and it was like, oh, my God, this is hilarious. Anyway, so there's like the apartment. The main thing about the apartment was that it should be like really sort of not what you would expect the drug people to live in. It's, I don't know if you remember. There's this vivid blue paint, like the whole the. Anyway, the movie. I'm sorry. Here's the deal. The movie is the French flag. It's red, white, and blue, or red, blue, and white.
Oh, that's like a magic trick. You got me.
That was it.
I didn't see it. Because, yeah, the whole bank is red.
Yep. and
the whole blue. Trip out. The whole trip out is
that I don't know. That's like,
I think that was blue.
That's very no. Blue. Well, it starts out super blue, but down in the basement, then that's its own thing. But the rest of the movie is like all white, red, and blue. So I think the hotel in the very beginning, it's like he's just frosted, like he's sitting in a car and it's just white with his face. So, but this is the director telling me things. Like when I met with him, he's like, the movie was going to be like the French flag, and I'm like, okay, that's interesting. But
was Roger Avery good to work with?
Phenomenal. The making of that film was. Easy, you'd never say a movie's easy. But we were the two movies I was on the most the same page that I can think of was Little Odessa and Killing Zoe. Killing Zoe is the only movie we finished early. Like, the last day was a half day because we were just so, like, we know so well what to do. And just, all of a sudden it was lunchtime, like, we're done. It was like, I just remember that, I'll never forget. But, just real quick, I know this is all over the place.
No, it's good.
But there's two other cool things about Killing Zoe. Yeah. Three. One, the main thing is that the whole drugged out section, the idea was like, what can we do that you haven't, how do we describe drugs? How do we describe heroin or just like heroin / no sleep / just gone somewhere else? But, I had seen enough movies with drugs, and I'm sure he had too, that we knew that no matter what you did in our experience, to me, all it was like, oh, here's the drug scene. Yep. And it looked like movie equipment had been attempted. It's like trying to bend something and you can't, it won't bend. All you can do is put something on top of it or change the color of it, and you have to tell them, this is a drug scene. It won't feel like a drug scene in real life, of course, but it is, right? Yeah, you'll buy that.
Yeah.
And it's like, when's that going to be over? Okay, next scene. But what we found out, or what he found out, is like, and we would have accepted something like that, except for that, right at that time, this Claremont, which is a big rental house in LA, found, they took these lenses and basically invented what's called swing and tilt lenses, which now they have swing shift and tilt shift and all this stuff. But he built two sets of lenses, which were made for, he made them for commercials, because just like a 4x5 camera that has a bellows, it's like if you point a camera at down here at a whole bunch of products on this table, and you point it like this, these products will be in focus and these products won't.
Yes.
But if you tilt the the bellows and parallel it to these objects, then they'll all be in focus. So you're changing the focal plane. Like if I point a camera, the normal focal plane is there, but I can make the focal plane like that. So you can do that to make a whole bunch of things in focus. You can do it to make a pyramiding building straighten out. That's what it's for. That's what he created them for. Sort of high-end commercials. Well, Roger Avery heard about him because there was an article about the new Coen Brothers movie, whatever it was at that time, I don't remember. And they had rented
Miller's Crossing or...
Yeah, they had rented this one of these sets of lenses. So Roger's like, Coen Brothers are renting these lenses. You go, Tom, go check out the other set. Learn how to use them and we're going to use them. And I was like, okay, I have no idea what they do. I don't know, we didn't know what he's talking about. So I went over there with a friend and sort of learned how to use them and found out that just like you can make everything perfect that's wrong, you can completely ruin something that's normal and just mess it up. So I learned as much as I could, and there are no adjusters on there that have any key marks of any kind. There's like four ways that you can tilt and shift the lens, but there's no way to mark it. So every time you do it, it's different. So, and also, it takes a lot of exposure out of the picture. And they're shooting film, not digital. So, you're guessing. Like, how much darker did I just make it when I tilted it like this? And then there's no
feels
way...
like stopping it happened to me.
As soon as you take the bellows and do this and then do that, there's no way a focus puller can figure out what your focus is. Because your focus plane is over there somewhere. So, you got to pull your own focus. So, we're in a dark room pulling my own focus and doing the tilting myself. And
you have assuming, no idea what's going to come out of it.
And I assume it's going to come out great, because if I thought anything else, I would have killed myself. It's like we shot in there for 2 days and didn't get to see anything until we were done. And thank God it mostly came out really cool. And you could see through the camera, but I couldn't, there's no way to measure what the exposure was.
And so, and we didn't want to, we were both, I mean, he told me, you're not, you can't use a lot of light. I mean, one thing would have been to do the light of all that, you could have been able to tell much easier. But the ice, as you know, I don't know if you remember, that place is almost black.
It looked black, yeah, it was quite stunning, actually. Like, the whole sequence is quite stunning. And one thing, the effect of it is that, yes, you're disturbed from it, but after you settle into the sequence, you kind of feel like you're...
In it?
In it.
Good.
You just feel like you're in it. You just feel like
Well, that's the thing I liked, is that because that's what I was saying before about... Normally people have tried to do things with filters mostly, or post effects, and they always... They just don't... You aren't in it. It's there, and you're here.
Yeah, no, this,
and that's somebody else's experience. So the idea was, will these lenses, like... And I think they did, and I don't think there's another movie that uses those lenses still that has ever really... I've seen shots... But I've never seen anybody try to describe an event using those lenses. Here's that weird guy's point of view, or here's that shot of this person freaking out.
Yeah.
But we tried to put you like what it was like to be Zed Eric Stoltz.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, because
I think it worked really well.
Talk about trends. We were talking about bleach bypass earlier. This is another trend that's come around today.
Yes.
Tilt shift lenses, you know, you see them everywhere.
Yes.
And I didn't know that's what you used to create that sequence, and it was a fabulous.
As far as I know, it's the first time ever on a camera, on a movie, in a movie, because the Coen brothers didn't end up using the lenses. We found out later. It's like they had a lot of money, and they rented every cool thing they had in the rental house. And they didn't end up, there's no scenes in whatever that movie was. So our little tiny movie ended up being the first use of those lenses.
Gonna do a little audible Rorschach, if you don't mind.
Can I ask you to just tell you one more quick thing about Killing Zoe?
Yeah, 100%.
It's really quick. By that time we made that movie, people who knew me knew that I was a massive Kubrick fan.
Yep.
And I think mostly The Shining. I just fell in love with The Shining. It was like my kid's show when I was a little kid.
We
I
just wanted to see that. It continuously. You never do the next time. Next time we interview you, what we're going to do is we're gonna pick like 4 or 5 Kubrick films, and we're just going to talk about them.
That sounds like the best thing ever.
It was going to be great. Okay, so anyways, keep going.
But really quickly, Killing Zoe was, the budget was under $1 million.
Yeah.
And I
had... Under $1 million?
Yes.
In 93?
Yeah, it was like 900,000. It was just under $1 million.
For the guy who co-wrote Pulp Fiction?
Yes. Well, we'll tell that to that later. But there's a reason. That movie was made with a little blessing. And I just wanted to tell you, the reason I even mentioned the budget is that I had done a couple of movies ranging between $1 and $5 million before that movie. And... So under $1 million, when you're early in a career and you're just starting to go up, it's like, I don't know if I should do that. I am worried. There aren't that many of me around. Somebody will notice that I just am doing this little movie. Plus, I want enough money to like pay the rent. So Roger knew that before he met with me. And he had seen something that he really liked, and he wanted me to shoot it before he ever met me. I don't even remember what it was or why now. But I just remember he met me in a coffee place out, sitting outside in L.A., all pretty and nice. And almost the first thing he said was, I'm making a movie, it's about a bank heist, and I know you might have read it, but before you tell me that you didn't like the script, there's just one thing I want to tell you. I want the bank in my movie to be like the chateau in The Shining. And I was like, oh, you fucker. You got me. Do it. I'll do the movie. Who told you? Like, how did you know?
And that's why.
And that's why, so I just said yes immediately. And well, we did our best. He did want it to, but it was out of love for The Shining. But I think it was mostly because he knew that I was like, he found out from somebody that I was like a fanatic Kubrick fan, and that if he said something like Kubricky, that I would probably do his movie. Because he said he'd like completely undercut his script, which he wasn't doing. He didn't mean to undercut it, but he was like, "I don't know if you like the hyper violentness of this movie. I don't know if you really like the script, but I just want to tell you one thing." He's like Kubrick, like The Shining, and I was like, "Fuck, yeah, okay, I'll do it."
That's fabulous.
So that's that story.
Tom Richmond, thank you for joining us. This isn't the end. This is only a pause.
Cool.
We'll pick it up again when we can. We'll talk about more of your work, a lot more of your work, and a lot more of other people's work too, because obviously we like doing that. and you like doing that. Yes. And now that we've finished, and thank you for joining us. It was a real pleasure.
Thanks. Go Canada.
And now that we've done that, now I'll introduce you. Cinematographers tend to go through Welcome Back to Craft Truck, Through the Lens. Cinematographers often have careers that shift and turn. And sometimes they get pigeonholed into doing one type of thing. And sometimes you run across an artist who has done everything and continues to push themselves into boundaries of completely different styles, types, and shapes, and doesn't stop developing as an artist. And we're very fortunate to have with us in the offices of Handheld Films right now, the one, the only, Whitey, Tom Richard.
Cheers.
Tom Richard.
It's great to be here.
Wait, you did your Rorschach pick.
What? Oh, yeah, let's do a little.
Wait, was that okay?
Perfect.
Oh, no, when you said has done everything, that's when I started laughing. I'm like, what?
I don't know about that. Save the gushing introductions for the end.
I mean, okay, so maybe you never shot dinosaurs, but who gives a fuck, right. You know? Okay, so let me just do Audible Rorschach with you now. I'll spin out the name. You just give me a minute or two.
Do I have to pay you for this?
No, not at all. not yet. That's later. That's like, oh, your agent didn't mention the fee? This is therapy.
You used to be able to joke about Canadian dollars, but that doesn't matter.
No, now ours were more. I could buy you.
Can you just get me into Canada next year?
Can you pay Canadian?
Yeah, can we get paid in Canadian dollars? No.
No! That's really fire.
Okay, so I'll say the name, you tell me what you think, just a minute.
I have such a bad memory, it probably won't do any good.
I bet you these will be okay. The recently deceased Harrison Vitti's.
The most artistic curmudgeon ever, or the most curmudgeonly artist I've ever met. I mean, he's a genius, I love him. And I did get to talk to him a few times.
Favorite movies of his?
Birth. And I like Birth, Milk, and American Gangster. Is that right? American Gangster, right? Shot on film, color timed on film when everybody was digitalifying. He's like, except for doom to doom. What's his big digital movie, like Michael Mann?
Zodiac.
Except for Zodiac, I believe every one of his films is shot on film and finished on film.
Optically timed, you mean?
Yes.
No DI?
Yes. No DI.
No DI?
Yes. I know American Gangster is that case. Since then, I'm not sure.
No DI to American Gangster.
Right. It was like a total... That was right around when I was sort of getting to know him. He used old-fashioned, you know, there's some... I say old-fashioned, it's so not old-fashioned, it's just a few years ago. But there's some name for, like, you know, regular color timing. But it's just a lab. It's not even optical. It's like, you know, laboratory color timing.
So the scene where he takes...
Which I did every movie.
Where he takes the wife's, the coat that his wife's bought him. I don't know if you remember this. His wife buys him a coat, a fur coat, mm-hmm. and it gets him in trouble because it's flashy.
Right.
And his rule was always don't stand out.
No, I do remember, yes. Yeah.
So he goes and he's got this apartment that's basically all white.
Yep.
Couch and everything. Yep. He's got this white fur coat and he throws it into the fire and he sits down and watches it burn. The effect of the lighting and the effect of the colors and everything just looks so like
that. Well, I wasn't there, but I do know, I mean, according to himself and according to the people I know that worked on the movie, it was completely...
In camera.
Yeah, in camera, yeah. And, you know, anything maybe the lab can do a little bit, but what you couldn't do is take sections of a shot and make them darker and lighter. It has to all be the whole picture. So it just means he, like, lit it the way... He's, you know, controlled a lighting person as there ever has been.
Wow. Roger Deakins.
Roger Deakins is my... I'd say still a hero. I mean, he's a... But... He's one of my favorite cinematographers ever. Now I could wish you. I wish I could remember the name of the film that first I fell in love with him from, which is a pre-Coen Brothers movie about a white kid and a black kid in Africa.
Not out of Africa.
No, it's a tiny little movie. And if we had... You could look it up on Roger Deakins' thing, but I don't know if we'll find it when we're done. But he's one of my heroes, and I'm trying to think. My most recent favorite Coen Brothers or Roger Deakins movie is A Serious Man, which is also, you know, total, that's shot on film. And it's like his, he, to me, he's just like the master of the negative, I guess you would call it, of the image. Like, there's something so sublime about his work. And I love it. I know I could think of more things if I was thinking about that longer.
Okay, well...
Fargo. Is Fargo? Did he shoot Fargo?
Yeah, he shot Fargo.
Yeah, you're talking about composition. If you go back to, like, you're teaching lighting, I wouldn't necessarily use Fargo to teach lighting. I might, but its effect, like, its storytelling... The compositions in that movie are the story, and I know it's also he does relate when you do, you know, Coen Brothers, they are, that's where director cinematography, it's one thing we really didn't talk about today, it's like DP does things with, there's always, that's the thing, it's never seen a movie in a still photograph, it's called a story and a director, and the Coen Brothers and Roger Deakins are like, you know, the crazy family, the wonderful crazy family.
Gordon Willis,
early hero, and do you know if he shot Manhattan?
He did.
Okay, Manhattan's one of my favorite movies visually, period, ever of all times. And he did the Godfather movies, or the first two anyway.
No, all three.
And he did, like, you know, just some other early Annie Hall, like early-ish Woody Allen movies. And he's also one of the first people that allowed alternative lighting, I would call it. I mean, like, oh, he's the guy with the top light, you mean? But the guy with the top light meant that you didn't have to do the exact portrait lighting that you learned from your teacher who had made movies in the early 50s and said, this is how you light a face. And he went, like... You know, Gordon Willis, with the blessing of Coppola anyway, and he made some other movies that most of us have never seen or heard of that are really good too, but he allowed cinematographers to start lighting for darkness, or like the celebration of darkness in pictures as opposed to the avoidance of it. So, needless to say, I also really like his style.
Tom, you rock.
Cheers.
Seriously, you rock.